Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Imagine a city block surrounded by cars. Cars are blocking the intersections, and so the vehicles are stuck. They can't move forward, and they can't move back. This is what we now seem to have in American politics.
Compared to other countries, the differences between the two major parties on most issues is not as big as it's represented. But we've gotten caught up in the political game in a way that's just not healthy. Gridlock, up ahead,
there's a line of cars as far as I can see. So how do we get people to stop blocking the intersections? Can we issue traffic tickets on Capitol Hill? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Friday, February 5th. And the takeaway for me is, you know, if you're going to carry that metaphor, the only thing that helps you solve gridlock in a city is some strong police officers and some strong traffic laws.
I actually like the image of Barack Obama as a political crossing guard. That's the one that works for me.
Yeah,
let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. The tarnish continues to spread over Toyota's image. We may be close to another recall. Reports the company and possibly the Department of Transportation considering a recall of 270,000 Prius hybrid cars in the U.S. and Japan. It would affect the new model, which went on sale in May of last year. This Prius owner tells NBC News that his car was having brake problems for months.
It's been frustrating, and I'm angry because, again, within 2 weeks of bringing the car in, I knew there was something wrong, and they were just in denial about the problem.
But this hour, Toyota's CEO will reportedly make a statement and answer some questions about this and other matters.
And the Prius problems don't end with brakes. The Los Angeles Times is reporting there have been over 1,000 complaints about the headlights shutting off without warning. Other Prius owners have complained of their cars shutting off completely, sometimes while in motion. For the latest, we're joined now by Jerome Vaughn. He's the news director for member station WDET in Detroit. Good morning, Jerome.
Good morning.
So what are we expecting to hear from Toyota's CEO? More mea culpas or maybe some details into investigations into the Prius and the Lexus?
I would say more mea culpas. I think he's going to apologize. I think he's going to reiterate how safe Toyota cars really are. And that's probably about it. Probably not a lot of detail.
We spoke to an LA Times reporter yesterday who said all of this could be the tip of the iceberg. What do you think? Are we going to hear more stories of problems in the days ahead?
I think absolutely so. I mean, I think for two reasons. One, investigators are going to be focusing on Toyota in the days ahead, and I think Toyota is going to know that it needs to come clean about problems or potential problems. So I think we will be hearing more.
Okay, General Vaughn, thanks so much. He's the news director for member station WDET in Detroit.
An offensive in Afghanistan by NATO has begun. British troops now carrying out helicopter advances in Helmand province, preparing the battlefield for what is expected to be one of the biggest assaults in the eight-year-old war. And we're getting word that a bomb has exploded last hour in the southern Pakistan city of Karachi. Police say at least 11 people were killed.
In Haiti, the 10 Americans who tried to take children out of the country last week without permission have been charged with kidnapping. They face prison terms of up to 15 years and are not eligible for bail. Here at home, the latest unemployment numbers will be announced later this morning. Expectations are for a tiny net increase in jobs, but the jobless rate could creep up to 10.1%. And the two main political parties in Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin and the Democratic Unionists, have reached an agreement in a long-running dispute over the police and judicial powers. Looking at the markets, Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,002. The S&P starts at 1,063 and the NASDAQ at 2,125. Later this hour, a conversation with soul legend Bill Withers. He's going to talk to us about the new documentary film, Still Bill.
We're discussing the notion of gridlock on Capitol Hill. How have you ended a stalemate in your life? What worked? Do you have a 60-vote veto in your family? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Gridlock on Capitol Hill coming up.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
By all reports, it's very difficult to get anything done on Capitol Hill. Both parties are complaining about it.
The Democrats' definition of bipartisanship is to unveil their own partisan bill and then expect Republicans to vote for it. I know bipartisanship when I see it. And it's not saying one thing and doing another.
That's Republican John Boehner speaking on Capitol Hill just a few days ago. But President Obama has also addressed this and says it's not just Democrats that are having a problem.
Progress doesn't come when we demonize opponents. It's not born in righteous spite. Progress comes when we open our hearts, when we extend our hands, when we recognize our common humanity.
That's the president speaking at the National Prayer Breakfast yesterday. So if we have gridlock on Capitol Hill, if we can't seem to find any common humanity between the parties, how on earth are we going to get any legislation passed? To talk about this, we have Nate Persily. He's a professor of law and political science at Columbia University. And William Ury is the co-founder of the Program on Negotiation at Harvard and co-author of the bestseller Getting to Yes, Negotiating Agreement Without Getting In. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
William,
good morning.
You've mediated a lot of conflicts in a lot of different areas. So can you give me an idea of how bad is it in Washington right now?
Well, I mean, they're not killing each other, but it's pretty bad in the sense of they're...
We got that going for us.
They're absolutely frustrating the country's ability to actually solve some very basic problems that face us all, and they're engaged in basically a contest in which each side is trying to win absolutely at the other side's expense, and the result is lose-lose and lose for the entire country.
So Nate, it hasn't all... I mean, the parties have never gotten along. I mean, the point is to distinguish yourself from the other party, right? But they haven't always been at this point where their definition of winning is the other party losing. So how did we get here?
Well, the parties right now are more cohesive than they've ever been, and they're also more ideologically farther apart. And by that I mean that there were historically we had, for example, the Southern white Democrats who were sort of brokers between the parties. But those folks have sort of disappeared for various reasons with the realignment to the South. And so we don't have that moderate middle who can sort of shift between the Republicans and the Democrats. And so the geographic and ideological bases of the party have become much farther apart.
But that's not necessarily a bad thing when you think of it in terms of focusing a party on, in and of itself and bringing everyone kind of in line.
Well, that's right. We have political parties that are very similar to parliamentary systems right now, where you have identifiable Democrats and identifiable Republicans. The problem is, in a system like ours, which has many veto points in the House, the Senate, the President, the more cohesive the parties are and the farther they are apart, the less likely you're going to have policy being made.
Unfortunately, this leads to the problem of always needing 60 votes to get anything passed. Right? Here's President Obama talking about that.
If the Republican leadership is going to insist that 60 votes in the Senate are required to do any business at all in this town, a supermajority, then the responsibility to govern is now yours as well.
So, William, we have this essential issue where, I mean, Nate, we have this essential issue where now it's gotten so far that you need 60 votes to get anything passed.
That really is an innovation. The use of the filibuster for normal policymaking is sort of unprecedented in American politics. It used to be that you'd have these legislators, you know, in the Senate up all night on very important bills, and that's when they would stake their claim. But now, even the threat of a filibuster is preventing any policy from being made.
And we're also not seeing legislation that where people cross over the aisle. I mean, that's relatively new as well, where it seems like every single bill, even the most basic things, are Republicans yes, Democrats no, or the other way around.
Well, that's also because there are very few moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats now by historical standards. It used to be you could peel away some people from the opposing party. There are fewer people to be peeled away right now. Everyone concentrates on the Republicans, on, you know, Olympia Snow and the few other Republicans who might be moderates, and then everybody points to Joe Lieberman and Ben Nelson and others on the Democratic side.
And they kind of demonize him. William, you know, this atmosphere now is so central to our political landscape. I honestly can't imagine how you possibly could change it. I mean, can we change it?
I think we can. I think we have to change it, and I think we can change the basic game, the way in which we deal with our differences. And it has to begin by building relationships. I mean,
like President Obama went the other day to, as a symbolic gesture, went and spoke with the House Republicans at their retreat, and they invited him. I mean, that's a step in the right direction. But basically, I mean, in the old days, people used to stay in Washington. They didn't just fly back on the weekends, and they used to actually socialize with each other, play card games and so on. I mean, they had a relationship. They built personal relationships of trust. Now that's becoming an increasing rarity. And I think we also need to begin negotiating out of the cameras. It's impossible. It's very difficult to negotiate in a fishbowl when you're negotiating on cable TV. And you know, we use Camp David, for instance, you know, for international disputes to get, you know, leaders out of the limelight, to really get them rolling up their shirt sleeves, you know, working together. Maybe we need to create a kind of equivalent of Camp David for domestic disputes.
Oh, so you're saying blame the media? This is where we are.
Well, it's not blame the media. It's just as hard when it's easy to fall back into ideological positions when you're on camera. That's it.
So Nate, if we get a Camp David, as William was just talking about, who attends a Camp David?
Well, it's not clear to me that the Republicans feel that they have much of an incentive, actually, to compromise. And this is also, it seems, a little bit unprecedented in American politics, where there's this notion that we have to get certain things done, but the Republicans don't see why it is that they have to compromise. And so this, now they have 41 votes in the Senate right now, and they're using it as a tactic in order to exact certain compromises from the president. And they don't see any reason why they should sign on to a health care bill or why they should sign on to a jobs bill, because they don't see any political benefit for them.
So William, when someone isn't motivated to compromise, how do you negotiate?
Well, I think what we need to do is, right now the negotiation is going on entirely about positions. It's my position, and I'm not giving in. And when it's about positions, people fall into a kind of fighting mode. We need to be able to peel behind the positions to really get the conversation focused on what are the underlying interests. What is it that we really want? What is it that we're really concerned about? Are we concerned about the fear of government intrusion? Do we want to, you know, take care of the needy? How are we going to balance those two? You need to begin to, instead of attacking each other, you need to begin to jointly attack a problem together. And that requires, in any negotiation where you're negotiating,
it's kind of bringing
stage.
Us back to the president's idea of finding the common humanity. That's William Ury, co-founder of the program on negotiation at Harvard, co-author of the bestseller Getting to Yes. And Nate Persley joined us, professor of law and political science at Columbia University. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
Toyota is considering a recall on 270,000 Prius hybrid cars over brake problems. And also this morning, the company says they're taking a closer look at the Lexus hybrid to see if it has the same problem. Consumer Reports' David Champion tells NBC News the automaker needs to take some fast action to save its image.
What they need to do is to fix all these cars really quickly. They need to jump on this Toyota Prius brake issue that's going on and really reach out to the customer, really make sure that their cars are right for them.
And Toyota's not the only automaker having problems. Ford says they plan to fix almost 18,000 of their hybrids because of a software problem that also involves the brakes. That decision involves Mercury Milan and Ford Fusion models.
At a fundraiser last night, President Obama said it's unbelievable that any American would be opposed to reforming a health care system that puts insurance companies over sick patients.
Everybody's been harmed by what's happened. And every voter out there, Democrat, Republican, Independent, is furious about what happened. So my hope would be that Washington would respond.
The president said his first priority is a jobs bill, but he plans to move on to a health care vote soon after that. Forecasters say a major winter storm is threatening some parts of the Mid-Atlantic, with D.C., Baltimore, and Philadelphia expected to bear the brunt of it. Meteorologist Bruce Terry from the National Weather Service says there's a dangerous storm. You could get additional 1 to 2 feet of snow on the ground.
That'll help the gridlock in Washington. That will certainly help.
It might, actually. Yeah. They'll stay home. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, inner-city youngsters and their special challenges when it comes to finding work.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway. from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some takeouts this morning. And for a moment, let's continue that conversation we were having about gridlock in Washington. This is actually something that Vice President Joe Biden was talking about yesterday with our own Todd Zwillick after the new Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown was sworn in. Here's what Joe Biden had to say.
It is a useful tool. It's legitimate. But I, from my perspective, it has been, having served here, having been elected to the Senate 7 times, I've never seen a time when it's become sort of standard operating procedure. If you want to get anything done, you have to have a supermajority. And I really mean this, unrelated to whether or not Barack and I are sitting down in the West Wing now. Any president in the future having to move through anything he or she wants, requiring a supermajority, is just, it's not a good way to do business. So hopefully, I don't have the answer. You're about to ask me, I don't know what the answer is.
So we're joined now by Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, that's part of the conversation you had with Joe Biden yesterday. He clearly sounds very frustrated. Was this frustration also reflected during his time that he spent as a senator?
Well, when Joe Biden was a senator for, what did he say? Was elected 7 times to the Senate. He didn't serve that 7th one because he became VP. But he used the filibuster, just like most senators do. He was never leader. But Biden is frustrated, like all Democrats are frustrated right now by the filibuster. But he stopped short of what some Democrats are calling for, and we've covered it on this show, changing the filibuster rule or making it 55 or 52. He didn't say that because that would be sort of another nuclear option. But he is sensing the frustration from the White House. He says the president is frustrated as well, and what he's hoping for is some relief from what he calls the spasm of partisanship.
We'll see if there's any movement in the future. Thanks so much, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
An unusual economic takeout now as we wait for the unemployment number later this morning. You know, it's probably hard to feel the sting of a recession if, say, you're an investment banker, right? And you're getting only a $2 million bonus. Okay, maybe the number's down, but you're not really feeling any change, any actual sacrifice. But at the other end of the economic spectrum, the recession is also abstract to people in communities who never saw much of a boom the past 2 decades at all. So Ibrahim Abdelmateen, normally our sports contributor, he sort of lives an economic double life, we learn. He joins us early in the morning, hears all those economic statistics that lead our newscasts, but then by day, he's a community and youth leader in East New York, a neighborhood that prosperity has passed by for generations, and that most New Yorkers never venture out to, since it's on the outskirts of Brooklyn and only connected by 2 major train lines. The faces of the people in this neighborhood you can't see in the statistics, and their faces Ibrahim Abdelmateen sees every day. We wanted to meet some of these people. Ibrahim, good morning.
Good morning.
So let's talk about East New York. What does it look like? And, you know, it's not a boom or bust economy. It's been bust pretty much for as long as you've ever been associated with it.
It's a very industrial neighborhood.
Right.
When you look out into the landscape, you look and it's a very bleak area. But I think Ramasu Ryan, who's one of the young people that I work with, he can describe it the best way.
I live in East New York. I live in Brooklyn. There's a lot of broken down houses. There's a lot of broken down lots. There's a lot of drug houses, crack spots. And like, you don't even have to walk that far from the train station in order to see a group of gangsters on the corner slinging drugs.
So how old is Ramasu? He's a job trainee.
Ramasu, I believe he's 20. He's a new dad. He's trying to make a decision. Should he join the training program and get ready, get the skills to get out into the workforce, or should he go into the military, which is something that he had wanted to do for a while, but then the urgency of it came even more so when he realized that he was going to be a new dad.
So, you know, there's an uphill battle trying to get work if you're from East New York because the unemployment rate, I think, dwarfs the 10% unemployment that's in the United States.
That's correct. Actually, according to the Fiscal Policy Institute, it's 1 in 5 people in East New York are unemployed, which is the highest unemployment rate in the 5 boroughs in New York City.
So you're facing that statistic, which sort of says, all right, it's economically bleak in this neighborhood. What other messages do young people get in East New York, which might suggest to them, hey, forget about boom or bust. You guys aren't going anywhere.
Oftentimes, I see young people that they're very sensitive. So you criticize them, and they want to snap at you. You know, you joke with them, and then they're like, I don't know anything. So they're very sensitive. It goes back to some of their experiences when they were younger. We spoke with Ian Hardy, and Ian's 19 years old, yeah. And well, he's been badgered by negative messages ever since he was in 8th grade.
I was in 8th grade in my classroom, my social studies class, and my teacher, she said, I will never amount to nothing, so, like, don't bother coming to school. or taking any like tests and stuff like that.
Well, we talk on this program a lot about discouraged workers, people who don't look for work anymore, who don't show up in the statistics, and we're solidly in this population at this point. And I imagine it takes a certain wisdom to negotiate how to pull people out of this kind of a economically distressed community. What do they think of you?
Well, that's funny. We were talking the other day about how do I connect with them? You know, my experience wasn't necessarily their experience, but I don't think you need to have a similar experience to connect with young people that come from difficult backgrounds. There's a saying, young people from the urban areas and young people from the suburbs, they all have the same levels of intelligence, same level of understanding, same level of work ethic. But the difference is the kids from the suburbs believe that their analysis is going to change the world and change their life. The people in the urban areas, they think that their analysis is irrelevant and it's not going to change their life.
But occasionally you meet somebody who definitely has an attitude that sort of stands out. Listen to this.
People say it's not jobs out here, but it is. You just have to, you know, you have to look. And like when you get turned down, I think people take it as a negative thing. Like if it just turned into a positive thing, is like they don't hire you. Well, you could say like they missed out on like a good worker or something. You know, like if you motivate yourself, you won't be put down.
It took her 2 extra years to graduate from high school. That's Carrie L. I love the hope and the honesty that comes from these young people. And that's the biggest thing, is that with all these difficult pressures, they're still able to find this fissure of hope that will carry them through.
And you tell them every day that there are opportunities out there in the green economy, even in a place like East New York. Do you believe that?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I mean, with all the weatherization work that needs to happen, with all the innovation that needs to come, some of the innovation is going to come from these young people.
And the solution in part comes from our own Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor on the streets of New York every day. Ibrahim, get to work now. We're going to talk to Ibrahim about sports later on this morning, but you can hear more from those young people that Ibrahim works with a special audio slideshow at thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, you can read Ibrahim's blog post about the decade he spent working with young people sort of beyond the boom and bust prosperity of the mainstream U.S. economy. Coming up, yet another case filed against the Toyota Motor Company.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, strategic and design flaws over at Toyota. Another new disturbing case about a Toyota vehicle. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. One of the largest offensives in the Afghan war has begun as of this morning. British attack helicopters now clearing the outskirts of the city of Marjah in preparation for NATO troops to come in. General Stanley McChrystal, top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, was asked why he announced the Helmand offensive in advance.
We're not interested in how many Taliban we kill. We'd much rather have them see the inevitability that things are changing and just accept that.
The assault on Marjah itself will be the first operation to employ some of the 30,000 new troops that are a part of President Obama's surge. We're learning new details about that attempted Christmas Day bomber. CBS News is reporting the suspect told investigators he was directed to carry out the attack by the radical Yemeni cleric Anwar al-Awlaki.
In Haiti, the 10 Americans who tried to take children out of the country last week without permission have been charged with child kidnapping and criminal conspiracy. Last night on Larry King Live, the Haitian Prime Minister Jean-Max Bellerive said the charges were earned.
It's clear that those people violated the law. What we have to understand if they do it in a good faith or if they were linked to other traffic.
The Americans face prison terms of up to 15 years, and they are not eligible for bail. Here at home, the latest unemployment numbers will be announced in about 2 hours. Expectations are for a small net increase in jobs, but the jobless rate is expected to creep up to 10.1%. And world stocks are tumbling this morning on the heels of ballooning European debt and a rise in U.S. unemployment claims. That's adding to fears that the global economy could slip back into recession. Yesterday, the Dow briefly fell under the all-important 10,000 mark for the first time since November. Let's check the markets now. Asian and European markets are down and futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,002. The S&P starts at 1,063 and the NASDAQ opens at 2,125. That's a look at some of the stories that we're following this morning.
So we may be getting close to another Toyota recall. Officials in Japan said Friday that they were considering a recall of the 2010 Prius Hybrid because of a flaw in the car's anti-lock braking system. The flaw could affect other models as well. But just a short week ago, Toyota seemed to have this huge reservoir of trust. Listen.
So far, I have had no problems with my cars, and I'm sure if there a problem comes up, they can fix it. I have implicit trust in, ample trust in Toyota.
I've always liked Toyota. They're so dependable, and I've talked to people, too. They will stick with Toyota because they're previous owners, and they still will trust Toyota.
Well, despite the recalls, the company is certainly betting that its customers will stand fast, but both because of the way cars are designed these days and because of Toyota's pattern of reluctance to respond to reports of problems, there are increasing calls for a broader look at the entire industry.
We'd like to see the government and the auto industry set up a task force to take a fresh look at all the issues associated with the electronics and the electrical systems in modern automobiles.
Is this about the electronics and the electrical systems in all cars, or is it about Toyota? That's Clarence Ditlow, an interview with the Associated Press yesterday. He's the director of the Center for Auto Safety in Washington. But now a new case involving the crash and death of a former auto worker driving her 2005 Toyota Camry may raise some new issues across the Toyota product line. We're joined by New York Times Detroit Bureau Chief Bill Vlasic, William Vlasic, who writes about this in today's paper. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
So let's talk, first of all, about this specific case and then raise this sort of broader issue of whether the electronic design of cars at Toyota and other makers actually causes investigators to look at the entire product line of these companies. First of all, what happened to this woman?
Well, this fatal accident in Flint, Michigan, in 2008, 2005 model Toyota Camry driven by a woman by the name of Guadalupe Alberto. Very, a very violent crash, one car crash, car speeding wildly out of control, in the middle of a Saturday afternoon. And no floor mats in this car, and this car was also not among those that were recalled for sticky accelerator pedals. Therefore, it really can't be explained by the actions Toyota has already taken.
And let's just pause there for a second. There was some discussion by the company that the mechanical problem that motivated this recall of 4 million vehicles had something to do with the floor mats, but if they weren't in the car, this obviously isn't the case here.
No, they have to eliminate floor mats and problems with a sticky pedal because, again, this car was not in their recall group. The lawsuit is alleging that this was a problem with Toyota's electronic throttle control system, which is a very sophisticated computerized device that controls the speed of the engine on many, many, many Toyota cars. Toyota has steadfastly said there is nothing wrong. They cannot find any problems with their electronic systems, but clearly the government is looking very closely at this, and Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood the other day said that electronics are sort of the next stage of this inquiry.
You know, he's been on our program talking just broadly about the electronic sort of proliferation within the cockpit and within cars is a real problem for him and raises a lot of issues for him. You heard Clarence Ditlow of the Center for Auto Safety in Washington there talking about the government needs to take a fresh look at cars. Do you think these electronic designs possibly motivate a completely different view of safety than we've had up till now?
They're extremely complex and proprietary in many cases to each different car maker.
Uh-huh.
And as we've found in looking through investigations by the government previously into Toyotas, it appears that the National Highway Traffic Safety Agency may not have all the technical capabilities themselves to analyze this equipment. So
let's unpack that for a second, William Vlasic. So if it's proprietary, that means the company actually keeps it a secret. So investigators trying to figure out the safety concerns of a particular design actually don't even have access to the design files.
Well, what they have access to are complaints of incidents, and automakers, you know, are required to turn over any data that they have on any accidents or complaints from consumers. In this particular case, Camrys have been investigated for this electronic issues, but sometimes they don't get all the reports because there's so many of them. Sometimes they segregate them. It's just a very complicated new area that is going to require a different kind of technical expertise than looking at traditional mechanical issues in a car.
Right. Well, on the one hand, you're talking about design and electronics that have moved beyond the capacity of regulators to actually oversee. But what do you think this particular case is going to mean for Toyota the next few days or weeks?
Well, this case case is drawing comparisons to the very awful crash out in San Diego last summer that killed four people, including a highway patrolman, where you just have a very, very high-speed, essentially one-car accident with an experienced driver and a car with no problems previously. Unfortunately, sometimes these horrible accidents are what get the draw the attention to a specific problem. And, you know, these may be rare occurrences, but they're catastrophic. And so I'm expecting that this case, along with a few others that were really violent crashes, will probably heighten the interest of regulators and maybe lawmakers as well to look at the electronics.
And we're expecting more out of Toyota, possibly not on this particular case, but certainly they're up against the wall on a whole range of issues. William Vlasic, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you.
Bill Vlasic is New York Times Detroit bureau chief, speaking about Toyota and a new case that's written about in our partner, the New York Times, today. Coming up, the soul legend Bill Withers joins us to discuss the new film Still Bill, which documents the singer's storied life and music career, which is as if we need an excuse to play any Bill Withers music.
Sometimes if I tell somebody who I am, they'll say, no, you ain't.
Lean on me, lean on us. Bill Withers coming up later. And we're also discussing the notion of gridlock on Capitol Hill. In your life, have you ever faced gridlock with a friend, a coworker, or a family member? How do you break a stalemate in your life? Tell us the story at 8778-MYTAKE or email us, mytake@thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. So a lot of big news came down the line yesterday regarding allegations of fraud at Bank of America. Here's the first one. The Securities and Exchange Commission announced a new settlement with B of A, and the Attorney General in the company's home state of North Carolina also announced a new settlement. But New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo filed new charges of fraud against both the bank, Bank of America, and two of its former chief executives. Here with details now, we have Louise Story, finance and business reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Louise, there was a lot of news coming out about B of A. Maybe you can give us the rundown to help us understand what happened.
Good morning. Yes, it was kind of like all these different agencies were just racing each other to make announcements. You know, we're sitting there, and first, Attorney General Andrew Cuomo from New York, who's been investigating for the bank, said he had filed charges. You know, you've heard a lot about his investigation because there have been leaks of some of the different testimony he's taken, but these were the first charges. And he's filing the charges under the Martin Act, which gives the Attorney General of New York very big powers over securities investigations. And what he's accusing the bank of is not disclosing the losses at Merrill Lynch, which Bank of America bought at the height of the financial crisis before that deal closed. Merrill Lynch just fell apart. It was bleeding money, and Bank of America kept that a secret from their shareholders even when they voted on the deal. So he did that. At the same time, you're right, the SEC, which had a major case running against the bank, settled it. And if you recall from last August, the SEC already settled something with the bank, and a judge threw that out. Do you remember this? I mean,
it was like
this never happened. The SEC and the bank were going to just kind of wipe their hands of this thing really fast, and a judge threw the settlement out. So this is a much larger settlement, but it'll have to go back to that
same judge.
The judge
said, you can't do this. You can't just make this quick settlement.
That's right.
These issues are
the
too large.
The judge was very critical. His name is Jed Rakoff. He's in New York. He's very well known for kind of taking maverick views. And he said this fine, it was $33 million. It's too small. So this time around, the fine is $150 million. And he said, why aren't you pointing the finger at executives? This time around, the SEC has not done that. So that may still bother him. And they'll go before the judge on Monday, and he may or may not approve this one.
And that's what a lot of people are saying, that is because there's no indictments of CEOs or executives from the bank, he may throw out this settlement as well.
It's hard to know. But when you look at Attorney General Cuomo's case, there are very clearly our fingers pointed in particular at Ken Lewis, who was the CEO of Bank of America till he retired at the beginning of this year, and at Joe Price. And I will tell you, when you read this 90-page complaint, it's pretty damning, in particular for Joe Price. There's a lot more in there about him. It says that he did not tell Bank of America's own lawyers how bad the losses were. So when the lawyers were giving him advice on whether to disclose the lawyers, he was obscuring from them, according to the complaint, how bad it was. And in fact, there's a scene in there where Joe Price, the former CFO, is sitting there with his deputies, and one of his deputies says to him, "Joe, I don't want to be talking to you through a sheet of glass." You know, meaning like right. In jail.
Yeah, okay. Wow. Holy story. We're definitely going to have to be following how this goes and whether this results in a real trial against these executives. Louise Story, business and finance reporter for the New York Times. Coming up, we'll be talking to soul legend Bill Withers. We're also asking you today, I wonder if there's people in your life that you feel like you're too polarized to even have a conversation with them. Not necessarily just on politics, but maybe on food. How do you get over these polarized opinions? 877-8-MY-TAKE or
my
take at the takeaway.
I can't talk to you anymore, Celeste.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee, and we're trying to make head or tails of this emotional roadmap we're looking at.
You know, it's okay to head out for wonderful, but on your way to wonderful, you're going to have to pass through all right.
All right, there on your left, soul legend Bill Withers talks to us about his emotional roadmap. That interview is in just a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on leading stories coming right up to 48 minutes after the hour. In about 10 minutes, Toyota's president will speak for the first time since the automaker issued those massive recalls we've been reporting about. This morning, we've learned that Toyota is considering a new recall on 270,000 Prius models because of alleged brake problems and is now looking into similar problems that may affect the Lexus brand. Yesterday, California Representative Daryl Issa says he wants to see Toyota's records on the Prius brake problems.
What we're going to ask Toyota to do is be transparent in showing us what they know, what they suspect, and what they're doing about it.
More on this developing story as we learn about it this morning.
The Federal Reserve is buying $1.25 trillion in mortgage-backed securities. It's an effort to prop up the economy, but they plan to stop the purchases on the final day of March. They said they'll consider reopening the program, though, if interest rates spike. In other economic news, we're waiting for the latest monthly employment report. It comes out at 8:30, and we'll get that to you as soon as we have it. Our daily look at an international business. China is expecting to impose heavy tariffs on chicken products that are imported into China from the U.S. China says U.S. companies such as Tyson Foods dump chicken feet and wings into the Chinese market at uncompetitive prices. Why do we care about chicken this morning? Joining us now to explain is BBC Shanghai correspondent Chris Hogg. So what's so important about the chicken trade between the U.S. and China?
Because it's worth $700 million, and it's about the only industry which has any success when it comes to exporting from the U.S. To the Chinese.
Are we expecting China to continue this sort of sniping at different trade disputes with the U.S.?
Yeah, I think we can expect much more of this. I mean, there are all sorts of trade disputes going on now. Everything from chicken to cars to steel pipes even. There is probably nothing that is left to chance here. This is piling on the pressure. We've seen other kinds of problems all week, really, between these two big superpowers, and this just piles it on even higher.
Generally, when you see a government doing this kind of thing, it's because they want something. So what does China want? Do we know?
Well, in fact, this was all started as a response to President Obama's decision last September to impose 35% tariffs on cheap Chinese tires. The Chinese were really angry about that. They felt that it wasn't a justifiable penalty for anything that they'd done wrong. They thought he was pandering to domestic interests, and that's why they hit back with this investigation into the American poultry industry.
Okay, Chris Hogg, Shanghai correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Thanks so much. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
Lean on me when you're not strong.
We got a movie music segment this morning. You have a musical background, right, Celeste?
I do.
Yeah,
I do.
That is a song that you listen to it and you go, how could somebody write a song like that?
Just sounds where does that come from?
And, of course, Lean on Me is the Bill Withers tune. And as a very special guest for this segment, we have soul legend Bill Withers, who's famous not only for that song, but also Just the Two of Us.
Yeah.
Ain't No Sunshine.
Ain't No Sunshine, yeah. Absolutely.
And Lovely
Grandma's
Day.
Grandma's Hands.
The movie connection here is Still Bill. It's a new film that documents Bill Withers' career and life from his early days, being raised by his grandmother back in West Virginia, to his Grammy Award wins, his choice to step back from the music industry when he was at his peak. Good morning, Mr. Bill Withers.
How are you?
How do you write a song like Lean On Me?
Well, you're kind of walking around scratching yourself and something crosses your mind, you know? I don't know.
Man, that says it all.
I have no idea how that process works.
Well, Bill Withers, let's talk about your early life and your grandma and the song Grandma's Hands.
Grandma's hands clapped in church on Sunday morning. Grandma's hands played a tambourine so well. Grandma's hands used to issue.
So Celeste referred to that song just a moment ago. I can see your grandma in that song.
Yeah.
Tell me about your grandmother and how much influence she had on you.
Well, I don't think it was just my grandmother. People as diverse as Johnny Cash and Barbara Streisand and people have mentioned their grandmothers, you know, when we had conversations about it. I think everybody's grandmother, you know, unless she's on crack or something, has sort of the same effect in their lives. So a lot of people are kind of soft on that secondary parenting, for lack of a better word. You know what I mean?
Right.
Grandmothers just kind of, you know, by that time in their lives, they've softened up a bit, and they have the advantage of being able to send you home when they get tired.
There you go. And they always believe you're going to make it. Describe the 70s when you were about as big a musical star as anybody in pop music.
Well, I don't know if I ever was that big a star. I probably gotten more attention since I stopped doing it than when I was doing it. When I was doing it, mostly I played small clubs, which were like my favorite. But I think that the fact that some of this subject matter translates between generations. I mean, grandmothers ain't ever going out of style. You
That's
know what
right.
I mean?
And there's nothing but classic in this tune right here.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away.
You know, that's such a very sparse arrangement. It's just you and a guitar and a bass, right?
Well, that was basically me and the MGs. Remember Booker T and the MGs?
Sure.
That's me and the MGs minus Steve Cropper. Steven Stills filled in because Steve Cropper couldn't make it. That ain't a bad band to get started with, huh?
You could do far. You know, worse than that. But, you know, the thing about that song for me, Bill Withers, is that song is so nakedly emotional. Like, it's just completely and totally heartfelt. And that's not an easy thing to musically express something that seems personal to me when I hear you singing it.
Did it make you see something?
It made me feel something.
I'm kidding with you.
There ain't no sunshine when Celeste is gone from this studio, I can tell you.
That's because I turn off the lights.
I would think so. Celeste sounds like a very cheerful person.
So, you know, part of the story in Still Bill is really the difficulties and the changing world for African-American musicians. Do you think the world is a better place for black musicians today?
Man, hopefully it's a better place for everybody. Yeah, I would say so, because the young people that have come along, people like Jay-Z and P. Diddy and all those people, they really are good business people, and they're into ownership of what they do. A long time ago, they just buy them a Cadillac and, you know, and give them some pocket change, you know.
You know, there's a moment in your film where Cornel West, the historian and African-American philosopher, really asks you what you want your legacy to be, and you don't really have an answer for him. Do you have one now?
Nah, I don't care. Legacies are for people who've died. I won't be here, so, you know, whatever somebody wants to do, have at it. I won't feel the pain, you know.
Celeste and I were talking about our favorite Bill Withers tunes, and we were saying that these songs are like friends.
Yeah, they
They're
become
like
part of your part of history, yeah.
They're almost your babies. Do you have a favorite?
No, but let me tell you an interesting thing about that. A lot of times, I'm not necessarily identified with the songs. They're just songs. I'll tell you a funny story. One Sunday morning, I decided to go to Roscoe's Chicken and Waffle and indulge my need for cholesterol and fried stuff and, you know, just do it up at Roscoe's.
Lord be praised.
And there were these ladies sitting in this booth next to me, and they were talking about this Bill Withers song. So I thought I'd have some fun, so I stuck my head over the booth, and I said, you know what, ladies? I said, I'm Bill Withers. And they said, no, you're not. You're too light-skinned to be Bill Withers. You don't even look like Bill Withers.
So legacies are really unimportant.
So the songs kind of go on their own, which is fine with me. It saves me a lot of trouble, you know?
Well, no trouble talking to you, Bill Withers. Soul legend, famous for the classics Ain't No Sunshine, Lean On Me, and Lovely Day. And, of course, the subject of the movie Still Bill, which is being screened around the country right now. Bill Withers, have a great day.
You too, bud. And Celeste, keep smiling, sugar.
I will, thanks.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Nice to start a Friday with that kind of music on the show, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Earlier on the show, we talked about gridlock on Capitol Hill, and we're wondering about gridlock in your life. Have you ever found yourself locking horns with somebody, even at work or at home, and where you felt like there was just no common ground between of you? How did you break the stalemate? Did you? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry, sugar. This is The Takeaway. And the world's all.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.